Hello, everyone, and welcome in to Debate Night. Yet again, we're joined by Brody in Georgia now. Hard to keep up with where Brody's at, but in Georgia, prepping for the major, fresh off of the Music City Open. The week of the Masters, which I'm assuming, I mean, surely you had a hard time getting a hotel room.
Yeah. This might have been a blunder situation. But I don't know what I could have done differently, honestly, because I was on the fence of whether or not I wanted to play in the Tallahassee Open, which is the Silver Series event that's going on this weekend in Tallahassee. I've heard actually some really good things from the course from a lot of people. So yeah. A lot of people are like, you should come play it. You'll love it. It's a lot of fun. But I also heard from a handful of people that W.R. Jackson is a course that you want as many rounds on as possible. So I was like conflicted because you go to Tallahassee, you're not done until, you know, Sunday night. And at best, you drive through the night or whatever to get up to Augusta or, you know, Appling, Georgia, where the actual course is. It's like a 7-hour drive, 7.5 hours, something like that. And so you maybe get a round in on Monday, maybe get two rounds in on Tuesday, and then another round in on Wednesday, and then you're off to the races. That's feasible. I think the other thing that kind of also was in the back of my mind was my body is, I wouldn't say breaking down, but I'm definitely starting to feel the effects of, I think I'm what, 5 weeks in a row right now, something like that.
I think so, because I think you said if you didn't stop, you were going to be 8 weeks straight if you didn't take a week off.
Yeah, and which I think is manageable for sure if you like are at the stage of your game where you're just trying to maintain things.
Yeah,
but I'm not at that stage. I'm at the stage of where, you know, I'm not just practicing the course and being like, oh, my putt was off today, let me work on that. Like, I'm practicing the course and spending a couple hours in the field trying to get my forehand better. And so there's like a lot of aspects of my game that I'm still trying to improve on. So I'm not just maintaining. So I'm kind of almost like double dipping right now. And I think that would catch up to me eventually. So doing Tallahassee Open, Masters Cup, Jonesboro, DDO, I might have died. So apologies to everyone that was looking forward to watching me play at Tallahassee. It's not going to happen this year. So apologies for that. But I think this is the best decision for me. With that being said, Masters Week in Augusta is an absolute chaos show. I don't know how my Wi-Fi is working, by the way. I don't know what's going on, but I'm not going to touch anything and move anything. But I'm currently in a hotel, and I've stayed in my fair share of hotel spectrums, right? I've gone to like the $40 a night off the side of the highway in the middle of nowhere, and I've gone to the, you know, $2,500 a night, like in a over the water bungalow. So I feel like I have a good grasp on what the price of a hotel is. This is a $50 hotel. This is a $50 hotel, and I would be happy with it. There's hot water. The water pressure isn't great, but there's hot water. The towels, these are a one and done type of towel situation where you can't really reuse it because it's so small and so thin that once you use it, it's pretty much, they might throw the towel away. I don't know if they actually do laundry. I think they just gave me a different colored sheet as a comforter. Nah. I think I have a white sheet and I have a brown sheet.
Was the brown sheet at one point white, or is it truly a brown sheet?
The textile of it makes it feel like it is a brown sheet.
Okay, that's good.
I have two pillows.
Keep that energy. So
that's decent. I have air conditioning, which is nice. You can see the TV. I don't know, Stiles, can you see that the TV is like mounted like I'm in like some sort of hospital room? It's a very odd.
Yeah, it looks like it's like 20 years old too.
It's mounted and it's off to the side. So like watching the national championship game was very awkward. Doors are super thin. I can hear the highway traffic, and then you can actually kind of see the blinds a little bit here on the edge. Blinds are absolute trash. As soon as the sun is up, the entire room is bright as a biscuit. So, I'm paying $180 a night.
Jeez.
So,
jeez.
Yeah. Yeah.
That changes the game, man.
Shredder.
It's just because it's Augusta week. It's Masters week.
A Holiday Inn is like $250 right now a night.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts. But I will be moving over to a, I almost said bed and breakfast. I'll be moving over to an Airbnb on Saturday, and I'll be staying at the Airbnb all week with Jonathan Nicholson and Ezra. So we actually found a pretty good little spot there. The other thing too is I don't know if you're familiar with like the I know you've played the course a bit, Hunter, but it's like there's nothing really near it.
No.
So
no, nothing at all. There's a Publix, I believe. And there's a chicken or is it there's a like 2 minutes down the road. There's a is it a Fresh Market or Whole Foods?
Maybe in a different direction than I've gone.
And then there's that chicken restaurant on the corner that's also a gas station. And there's a Zaxby's somewhat close. But beyond that, there's not much.
Yeah, I'm 30. Also, size, can you lower Hunter's volume just a little bit? Because he's peeking through my headphones. we haven't even talked about Duke yet, so I don't even want I want to make sure we lower it before we start talking about Duke. But it's a 30-minute drive. Which is not terrible, not ideal, but I think our Airbnb will be like 20 minutes.
Yeah,
so I'll be in a much better spot come Saturday. But we're dealing with crazy weather right now. It's supposed to rain for like the next 48 hours. So it's going to be interesting to see how the course handles all that water. And then on top of that, it looks like it might rain on Saturday and Sunday.
Mm.
Like tournament time.
So, oh, next week.
Yeah. Nice. And this is, we'll get into the course here in a little bit, but I can only imagine playing that course in wet conditions with like mud and like standstills in the fairway. So, but what you want to talk about, do you want to talk about the Duke situation? You want to get that out of the way?
I mean, if you want to bring it up, we can talk through it. Sure. Sure. That's fine.
I mean, first off, shout out to Tyler Hansborough for those motivational words that he sent to Hunter.
How much do you know about how much I hate Tyler Hansborough?
That was an incredible stand-up move that he would take the time out of his day to send that heartfelt message to you. And, you know, that's something that I'm glad that we were all able to share together. So that was awesome. So shout out to Tyler for that. And the game. Did you bet on the game?
No, I had too much. I bet all of my emotions on the game.
What was your fit? What were you wearing?
I was wearing a Duke hoodie and a Duke hat and sweatpants.
Okay. Did you watch it at your parents
parents? Yeah. Not in the basement, just on their normal TV. We were gonna watch it at home. But I knew being at my parents would keep me under control where I wouldn't be standing at the TV yelling. So it was a strategy play to be able to just kind of enjoy the game a little bit more. It somewhat worked. I ended up sitting on the floor in front of the TV for the whole night. But, you know, it is what it is.
Now that you've had a couple days to kind of decompress about the situation, like, what do you think went wrong?
Well, you know, it was free throws, the obvious answer. I mean, we missed like 12 of them and we lost by 3. But at the end of the day, what it all boils down to is it didn't even amount to anything because Kansas won it all. So Kansas is the national champions, and Carolina is the best of the losers, but a loser's a loser. I mean, you might as well just lost in the first round like Kentucky. I mean, you can't, if you're going to get all the way to the championship game, I think I'd rather lose in the Final Four than lose in the championship game. Because if you're in the championship game, you like can taste it. You can taste the victory. And then you, especially to be up like 15 at half and then have Kansas storming back and win. I mean, it's kind of all for nothing. It's kind of, I mean, it's sad to be a UNC fan right now, I think, because you were this close to making history, but at the end of the day, like, you got nothing. Bill Self came out and slapped you around. Like, what are you going to do about it?
But do you ever feel like, man, if we could have just beat UNC, we probably would have beat Kansas?
I mean, maybe. It's hard to say that.
Kansas looked terrible in the first half.
Yeah,
they
but then
make a free throw. They couldn't make a layup.
Yeah, the second half, though, I mean, they came out. It's tough to say that because we lost in the
Final Four. I think UNC that Love jacked up his ankle and he was never the same after that.
UNC's issue is most of the season they played five guys.
Yeah, Puff the Magic Dragon though came out hot to the point where he was vomiting on the dry heaving on the floor. I feel like we've all been in that situation at one point where you just almost black out and we don't really know what we're doing for a few minutes. And then when reality sets in, you just like your heart feels like it's about to explode. And I think that's what happened to him is like he just blacked out for 3 minutes straight, scored like 8 points, was the only one that could do anything for UNC. And then once reality set in, he just was on hands and knees and like was just trying to catch his breath. But I think both games, it's been a long, I mean, the Kansas Villanova game was kind of to me.
Yeah.
But it's been a while, I feel like, since I've watched the Final Four and there were like multiple good games.
Yeah.
I thought both games were really, really exciting to watch. Kind of nuts to see like Coach K, like that's the end. But yeah. I mean, I feel like if you're Duke, you probably would have rather just like lost in the Sweet 16 and that be like, well, it is what it is.
I mean, but making like, the Final Four is cool. I think if you know you're not going to win the championship, losing earlier and earlier, like the Elite Eight would have been a good spot to lose because then you don't get to the Final Four. Once you get to the Final Four weekend, you can kind of taste victory. So it changes your mindset from like, let's just win tonight to let's win it all. But
yeah,
I still think if you're going to lose, I would much rather lose in the Final Four than be UNC and have lost in the championship game after being up 15 and then blowing a lead. I would much rather be.
No,
I'd rather be sitting here as a Duke fan losing in the Final Four and not having to go through getting destroyed by Kansas, personally.
It's true. The only problem is like you guys have to, like for you to be able to have any sort of like, you can say that all you want, right? And I agree with you to a standpoint of where it's like, it does suck that they beat Duke and then they weren't able to complete it.
Yeah, they don't have a story now. They have nothing.
But like next year, if Duke beats UNC, you know the first thing they're going to say is like, well, we sent Coach K home.
And I'll just say, and where's your hardware to show it?
We retired Coach K.
That's the biggest thing is prior to them losing the national championship, as a Duke fan, you have no artillery to fight it. Because if they won the national championship and beat Coach K, double whammy. Like, what the heck are you going to say?
Oh, it would have been really bad.
But they didn't win at all. So, yeah, like, good job.
You made it
to the final game. Congrats. Pat on the back. But, you know, you don't have anything to show for it. It's a cute little run you made. Don't have anything to show for it, though. Kind of sucks, you know? Well, I mean, there was probably a moment. I wonder if the Gatorade showered Hubert Davis at halftime, being up that much.
No.
Did he come out?
No.
Did he change clothes at halftime? I mean, as a UNC fan, they were probably celebrating hardcore, you know? I wonder if any UNC fans turned the game off. They thought they won at halftime.
No. Man, someone did that?
I mean, I don't know.
Someone did that.
I'm just throwing ideas out there. It's a tough seat to be in as a UNC fan right now. Yeah, you made it, but like for what? You could have just lost in the first round, got extra rounds of practice. I mean,
if we're being fair, I think if someone could be in UNC shoes or Duke shoes, they would pick UNC shoes. It's not as good as it could have gotten, but
I still think you'd rather lose in the Final Four than the championship, though.
But they beat Duke.
Yeah, so but you got to the championship, and all for nothing.
It is what it is.
It's tough. It's tough. No one will even remember UNC from this season, really, when you think about it.
Well, the problem is I don't know when the next time, like, that was the first time Duke and UNC ever faced each other in March Madness. So yeah. When the heck will that happen ever again? Who knows? Maybe never in our lifetime. So.
Yeah, probably never.
But the tournament itself, awesome, incredible.
I wish St. Mary's would have made it farther. I was rooting for the Duke-UNC Final Four matchup, so I was rooting for St. Mary's just because I hate UNC, but I wanted the matchup in the Final Four, so I understood St. Mary's had to go, but it would have been electric if a 15 seed would have made the Final Four. I mean,
those stories are always cool.
Only issue with a high seed going as far as they did is some team, and this year was UNC, some team is going to figure them out because there's a reason they're a 15 seed. So, once a team figures them out, they're going to get destroyed. So, the Elite Eight, which is where they made it, that's as far as I like a team like that going. Because they're not going to win the championship as, a 15 seed especially. You're not going to win the championship. So, someone's going to figure you out.
How far did Florida Gulf Coast go that one year?
Sweet
Elite
16.
Eight too?
Sweet 16. Oh, Sweet 16. This is the first time a final or a 15 seed had made it to the Elite Eight. Mm. But Florida Gulf Coast, another great example. That's a fun run because it doesn't
Dunk
get
City, baby.
It doesn't get far enough into. Awesome. Yeah, that was incredible. Who was he's in the NBA now. Kenneth, right? The dude with dreads dunking all over everyone. Crazy athlete. He played for the Nuggets for a while. But anyways, that's a great run. Because Florida Gulf Coast, they get through the first weekend, they get into the second weekend. It's a great storyline. They knock off some good teams, but they don't get far enough that it ruins the final weekend of March Madness. Because you don't want a team that doesn't belong there being in the Final Four and having a team figure them out and win by 40. And it'd be okay, well, there's a waste of a game. So
I think that Villanova game would have been a lot closer if they didn't lose their second leading scorer. So,
yes.
It could have been two really good Final Four games. But this makes it, are we more excited for the match play event? After seeing this, we get a little bracket play ourselves in the match play event. It's a couple months away.
I'm always excited for brackets. Brackets make everything more fun.
More brackets, the better. All right. Let's talk Music City real quick.
Because I want to get your opinion as a player of the event on a few different things here.
Okay, what do you got?
First being the course design in general. You leading into the event, you liked it. I've seen several pros now be more vocal about dislike it.
Parts of it.
Yeah, I've seen several pros be vocal about disliking, not the course as a whole, but I think for a tour level course, disliking it, if that makes sense. One of the ones was obviously the whole Joel Freeman incident. I don't know if you saw that, where he was
I heard about it.
I think it was hole 11. He was in some really thick thorns, 25 feet away from the basket, and stuff like that, to where, having stuff inside the circle is fine, but thick thorns where you can't get to your disc, that's a whole different thing.
So let's break it down. Let's break it down. We'll go step by step. So the first thing you asked was what I thought of the actual course.
Yes.
And then we can go into Joel Freeman, slow play, results, all that stuff. So first thing is the course design. I don't know if this is the Disc Golf Pro Tour's theory or guideline of where they're hey, we want Silver Series events to be easier course-wise. I'm not sure. I don't know. It'd be very interesting to hear from them if that is something that they're Silver Series events are going to be courses that maybe aren't as challenging but that is kind of, so far, we've had three Elite Series events and two Silver Series, and both the Silver Series courses they have some holes to them that make you feel, and I guess Waco a little bit has some of those holes as well, of where it just doesn't feel as challenging. But first things first is hole one. I feel like I've said this 1,000 times. I don't think hole one, I'm not a fan either. I'm not a fan of starting on a short par three on hole one. And I feel like so many courses we've played, Waco, Belton's kind of like a hyzer 350 foot par three. Vegas, one of the courses is a short par three. Factory is like a 400 foot par three. And then Innova is like a 330 foot par three. And then would we just play Belton? Belton's a par three. So every course we've played so far starts with a par three, and some of them are like short little dinky par threes.
Yeah.
And that was exactly what we started here. I, as a player, I'm not a fan of it. I'm curious of like how spectators view it, because like if you tune in, okay, you tune in live coverage, you're getting jacked up. And they're like, all right, first on the box is, I'm trying to think who was on feature card first day. Probably Chris Dickerson. So we'll say Chris Dickerson. They're like, Chris Dickerson. Everyone's clapping. And you like see, it's like the basket's right there. It's 200 feet or 205 feet right in front of you. And he's lining up a shot. And then he goes and throws and he hits a tree 10 feet off the fairway.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? Like, is that... Are you thinking anything about like this is a weird hole to start, like, or is that you're just completely doesn't matter what kind of hole we start on?
I'm more when I see a shot like that, I more immediately think like oof, like not necessarily anything about the hole, but like that's a rough way to start a round, if that makes sense. Like I'm more thinking about the player, like oh you don't want to do that. I think in disc golf, because you like more of a like. Open par four essence to where your first shot, there's not a lot of risk. You just get off the tee and get going, right?
Yeah, just everyone rips something off the tee, gets out, and like moves on. So everyone, like when they announce you, everyone's clapping, looking at you. You rip a shot, everyone claps, and you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind.
versus this where there are people like throwing shots and then like, the next person's up and they're getting announced and like your disc is 10 feet in front of them.
Yeah.
About to throw.
I don't mind hole one being like a shot that you can mess up. Whether that's a par three or a par four, I don't like it being a shot that you don't feel pressure early in the round, but it's a shot that if it was late in the round would make you make a decision. Like hole one at Texas States, for instance, I think is a great example where hole one, since it's on that big mound, if you, in your head, you could easily just say, I'm playing for a three every round. But if that's hole 16, you might be 40 feet, and where it's hole one, you're laying up. Now that it's hole 16 in the round, you have to run that putt because you know how your round's going or you know where you stand. So I think with a location of like a hole like that works a lot better than later in the round. But like that's just a hole where you have to make a decision whether you're aggressive or lay up, because I think early in the round, a lot more players are going to make the safe decision, whereas late in the round, it allows for more excitement. So I don't like there being like a decision hole on hole one, but I don't mind it being a par three. I just think it in general, just kind of needs to be a good hole. Music City, it seemed like it was one of the like quote unquote forgetful holes, if that makes sense, to where if it was hole 12, it'd be the hole where you're like going through and you're like, dang, what is that hole 12? I don't think that's a good starting hole. I think if it was a like good, memorable par three, like an iconic hole on the course, then it would feel a lot better. But since it's just kind of like a short dinker forgettable hole on the course, it's makes you feel like a weird one. Yeah, it feels like it's a like weird way to start the round.
Wake a hole one.
Very similar. So
outside of I think this course had a couple holes that were some of the better holes I played on tour this year. 17, 4, 3 is a great hole, 2 is a good hole. There's some holes on the back nine that were pretty good, like 16, 15, 14, that stretch was all really good. And then there was just some holes that were just like not great.
Yeah.
So I think it was a mixture of the two, of where, you know, I thought some holes were incredible, some holes weren't. Outside of that, it does sound like the tournament directors and the people kind of running the tournament definitely were interested in hearing feedback from a lot of the players, which I think is great. Just with the fact that we don't really have the course designers and we don't really have the you know, the sport has developed so much over the last couple years that they need feedback right now from the pros. And 10, 15, 20 years from now, the growth between the top players from now and 10 years is going to be, you know, not as large as what it is now 10 years ago.
So
I think that was awesome to see them want to have some feedback. Now, do you want to talk about the thorns? Because I don't know if you can, see at home, I still have a couple cuts and scrapes on my face. I got destroyed out there. So I feel like out of maybe everyone in the field, I would probably have the best insight on some of the worst spots you could put yourself on this course.
Were the thorns that you went into, were they like you threw a really bad shot and so it's in the thorns, or were you like inside the circle like the Joel Freeman situation? Because I think those are two different situations when it comes to a course.
What hole was he inside the circle and in thorns?
A hole 11 is what has been claimed. On the right side of 11. You can tell he's in a thick bush.
The right side of 11.
Yes. Or
okay.
Yeah.
Hole 11 was the one that had like the little Y tree and you had to throw it through like a little layup forehand to the right, and then a lot of people were throwing like a spike hyzer up and over. I mean, it wasn't that thick over there.
That's where it occurred.
I'll say this. There were multiple occasions, like more than eight times, that had I thrown that shot that I did in the tournament in a practice round, there is no way in heck I'm trying to get in there and throw a shot. I'm trying to find a stick and I'm trying to like knock it out and grab it and get out of there and just throw, you know, where my other shot is. But I'm in a tournament and I have to get in there. Now, do I think that should be part of disc golf? I don't think that's a side that from a player standpoint that we want to play in. And I don't think it really adds anything from a viewer standpoint of where like someone throws a shot and then comes out and they're like pulling. I mean, there was one shot I did where I like got like four thorns in my hand. Cause like once I released, like I was literally in a thorn situation. So like I just did a little, like a high chop forehand and just barely caught the thorns in front of me. And it's had like four of them in there. So I don't think, could be wrong. Maybe people listening right now are going to be like, oh no, we want to see you bleed. We want to see blood. But to me, I threw the shot in there.
Yeah.
Right. Like if I would have thrown a better shot, I wouldn't be in there. So at a certain point I'm like, eh. But you know, here I am at WR Jackson. And again, this might be more of like a, just like a location thing of where like where we're playing in WR Jackson, there aren't thorns. And at this other course, there are. I wish there was like some sort of mosquito or something that you could release that just like eats thorns.
Yeah.
Because I love the rough at that course. Like if you got off the fairway at that course, which I did a lot, it was at certain points, it was like impossible to save par. Like you were not, especially if it was like a par three and you got off the fairway, you know, you weren't in circle two and you weren't, you know, 150 feet away. Like it was nearly impossible some spots to get into circle two, which I like because it's like you threw that bad shot, you should get penalized. But if there was a way of making it just as hard without the thorns, I'm all for that.
I think the biggest difference between the two courses is from what I understood, the course you played at Music City, correct me if I'm wrong, was like a temp course of sorts. Like it's a fairly new put-in course, right?
Yes, it's temporary baskets, and I guess they're pulling the baskets like a week after we left.
Yeah.
So they might,
So I think that's the biggest difference is like, of course, like WR Jackson's been played a lot, so you can get rid of the thorns and the foot traffic keeps them down versus a course like that. It's hard to maintain the thorns if it's not getting regularly played because there's like as a course develops, that's something with like new courses, it's always the undergrowth and thorns, poison ivy, all that type of stuff. Like you can kill it, you can get rid of it, but it's going to keep coming back unless it's like regularly played. So that's just something that like older courses will have more developed rough, to where it's made up of big trees or some strategic little trees, but there's not a lot of like undergrowth, thorns, yes, stuff like that you have to get into because they're regularly being trampled. So once they're down type thing.
Yeah, that makes, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think that is the rough that I like the most to play out of, is the one that is still very difficult to like maneuver to get out, because you have all the little trees and branches and all that stuff to deal with. But I like to have like, you know, no thorns, or like you said, the underbrush. If there's a way to just like force fire all the underbrush out, I think that would be the best scenario for the player standpoint, as far as just like, you know, getting in there. Now, if we want to talk about the Joel Freeman situation, it was, when I first heard about it, I was like, well, that kind of sucks. Like, why didn't the people on his card tell him, like, hey, if you do that, we're gonna stroke you? Because I guess what I heard, and again, this is like from a couple different people, so take that for what you want. But what I heard is he was like trying to get to his lie, mm-hmm, and said something verbally out loud of like, I can't get to my lie.
Yes.
And then proceeded to kind of just keep going back and back until he could throw a shot.
Well, he got the group to come look at it.
Okay.
So on coverage, you can see Nathan Queen and Dickerson, them looking at the lie. The issue was, because the issue here is the two people who are mainly in the story, one being Joel Freeman, he posted like kind of a cryptic, you didn't get much detail from Instagram post, basically just being like, it was unfortunate, let's just move on, it is what it is. Nathan Queen was doing the commentary. So the only like fully told out side of the story you hear is Nathan Queen's, which is right. This probably, the truth's probably somewhere in the middle, but Nathan Queen basically said,
what did he say?
He said that he walked up and immediately, and you can see it on coverage, he's like, yeah, right here, I'm saying I could get to that lie in 15 seconds. And so then what happened is the whole card walks away, and it appeared that there wasn't really an answer given to Joel yet. And so what Nathan says is they walked away and they were still talking about whether that was an unplayable lie or not. So they hadn't given him an answer. And that's when he marked farther behind, taking casual relief and threw. Yeah. So to me, it just seemed like this misunderstanding of Joel's part.
It seemed like a miscommunication thing of where he never got confirmation, because what I was told was they assumed, because he took it back there, that he was just taking it unplayable.
Yes, they thought he was taking the stroke.
So yeah, they thought because they basically didn't make it sound like it was unplayable, or not. Sorry, they didn't make it sound like it wasn't something. Because the only time you can do that is like if your disc is like up against a tree.
Yeah, like if you physically like can't get to your disc, you can take relief back.
Yes. And so I think they saw that, they weren't like, oh yeah, man, there's no way. Cause really, if it's a thorn bush, you can get your foot in there.
Yeah. You can find a way to get in there.
As much as it sucks, trust me, I have scrapes all over my body to prove it. It sucks. But I don't think in the rules, and maybe again, this is where it's like, I wish there wasn't thorns, because you can't put something in the rules of where it's like,
well, that's where the tournament director, it can't claim relief, casual relief from all thorns. So that could be something said at the meeting where you get casual relief backwards from all thorns. Or you can also designate specific ones. So you can say the thorns to the right of hole green of hole 11, you get relief from that. You can say that. Because so that's kind of the only solution that could have happened.
I don't like the, you know, I don't like the thorn situation, because It also brings into my thing of like, hey, like we need to be able to get like relief off of like fire ant piles and like other like gopher holes and all that stuff. But the problem is when you start saying like just disc golf courses aren't maintained well enough to where stuff can be easily like, oh, that is definitely a hole because it's surrounded by grass and that's a hole. And it's the same thing with thorns is like, you can abuse that rule.
Yeah.
If you're like, you get relief off of thorns. So regardless, they all thought he was taking unplayable. They get to the tee. They asked him what he got. He said four. They're like, isn't it a five? And I think that's how the story goes. Now, there was another incident too, which
I didn't hear. Yeah, I didn't even know this was after we did the podcast.
Another Joel Freeman.
Yeah, hole 17 or whatever.
Hole 17. So I didn't even know this was a rule. So for everyone listening right now, this is kind of an interesting rule. And again, this is where I think the PDGA is making rules for all tournaments. And this is where I think the Disc Golf Pro Tour needs to separate a little bit from the PDGA and say, hey, some of your rules make a lot of sense for flex starts and make a lot of sense for C tiers, but don't make sense for the Disc Golf Pro Tour. And this is one of those rules. Now, it was played the right way, so that was good. But basically, hole 17, you can either go up the middle. You got trees on the left, OB on the right. You can either throw like an up-the-gut shot, or you can throw a big hyzer out of bounds and then have it come back inbounds. That's what Joel did. His disc never came back inbounds. And so he ended up going up to where his disc was. And in the PGGA rule book, it does say that the tournament director essentially has the right to say how they want that the out-of-bound rule to be played, to where you either play it like how 99.9% of us play it, where it's where it last was in bounds, that's where you take it, or he has an option of basically saying like you can bring where your disc ends up, you can bring it in perpendicular to the out of bounds and take your stroke and play it from there.
Fascinating.
This is also a rule that the USGA has in golf as well. And again, this is to speed up pace of play at the lower level. Because if you have a hole that requires people to throw out of bounds and have it come back in, instead of having people just stand there and continuing to throw and throw and throw, this would speed up the pace of play, right? And that's, I think, why the rule was created. Does it make sense for the Pro Tour? Absolutely not. Tournament director came out, told him, no, you can't do that for this tournament.
I've never heard that rule before. I'm looking at the OB rule now.
I'm not second guessing Joel Freeman at all. The guy knows the rule book better than anyone else.
I'm second guessing him. But I'm reading the OB rule right now, and I'm gonna just see.
I'm telling you, it's in there.
I'm looking at it. I'm gonna look for it right now while we keep talking. Because it basically says a player's disc who's out of bounds receives one penalty throw. The player may play the next throw from the previous lie or a lie designated by a marker disc placed on the playing surface up to 1 meter away from the point where the disc was last in bounds. At the director's,
there's gotta be like an app.
Oh, you're right. At the director's discretion, the player may additionally choose to play the next throw from within the designated drop zone or a lie designated by a marker disc placed on the playing surface up to 1 meter away from the point of out of bounds line nearest the position of the disc. That must be a new rule. That's fascinating. So it's at the director's discretion, though. So the TD would have had to, same thing as the casual relief for the thorns. TD would have had to have said that before the tournament.
I'm telling you, Joel Freeman knows the rule book better than anyone I've ever met.
Knowing the rule book can save you a stroke or two, at least a tournament, maybe even a round.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
But that's where I
think. Were you going to say Silas? Silas, what were you saying?
You said someone in the chat.
Oh, no. I was just saying Todd said he looked it up. He said where to find it.
Yeah, I found it. So you're good. It was the next few points down.
Oh, nice.
That must have been added recently because that's fascinating.
Do you want to. You want to hear my crazy rule story?
Let's hear it.
Of how I stroked myself. Okay. So, well, maybe bad use of the word. How I took a worse score than I should have.
There you go.
So this was a hole that most players you saw throw like a chip forehand and then like another chip forehand, but you could throw like up and over the trees, like immediately off the tee pad. This was like a hole 8, I believe. Hole 8. You could throw like this high Annie. I don't know if it was on coverage, but Garrett Gerthy threw a shot like pin high on this par four. Ridiculous shot. But you can throw a high Annie flex and flex it like over and get way over there and then have like a straight 200-foot shot. So that is what I did the first 2 days. And just easy birdie, easy birdie. One of the days I got up, I was throwing my Janus Thrasher. And one of the days, the wind kind of like knocked it over more into a like a sky roller. And so it hit and rolled like another 150 feet straight. And there, it was probably like 20 or 30 feet short of these white stakes. Now, once I saw that, I was like, okay, are these out of bounds for us? Because I was like, I'm pretty sure when I looked at the T sign, there's like no OB on this course, like, or on this hole. And so I re-looked at the caddy book, and yes, lo and behold, it says OB over the fence, which is like so far right and like short that these, this is obviously not talking about that. And then there was no other OB on the course. These white stakes were for hole 17. So if you went too far on hole 17, that's these white stakes came into play because they kind of caddy, the two holes kind of caddy cornered together. So I'm like, all right, so I'm fine. If I somehow end up going past, I'm fine. Well, lo and behold, round three, my disc does the same thing, turns into a sky roller and rolls like another 50 feet further than before. And I get in the middle of this thorn bush past these white stakes. Now, in my head, I'm like, this is an OB. I know it's not OB. This is an OB. But, you know, I talk to the car by people on my card and I'm like, guys, there's no OB on the T sign. I'm like, there's no way that this can be OB. And they're like, yeah, we think that you should just play a provisional just to be safe. And yeah. I was like, all right. I was like, fine, I'll play a provisional. So I take my 1 meter in, and I end up, because I take my 1 meter in, I'm no longer in this massive thorn bush. And I throw them, get freaky up to like 5 feet. Okay. So I'm like, all right, well, that's a par for my provisional. So now in my head, I'm like, I'm going to see if I can get like a crazy flex forehand, like stand still. Again, I'm like, got thorns all around me. So like my range of motion is very minimal. I'm like, can I get a crazy flex forehand all the way up to the basket and maybe get birdie on this hole? Cause I'm like, this is the disc I'm actually using. Throw it. Go straight ultimate frisbee style, nose up, hyzers over into this other thorn bush. have no shot. So I just chuck something up there, get to about 30, 32 feet. And now I'm walking up being like, okay, what the heck? And I missed the putt. And which also puts me in a really weird spot because I was my other shot was also out because everyone else parked it. So like now I'm like that I have to, I'm like, it was really weird. Cause like I need to get that putter, but I need to mark this disc and mark that disc. It was a weird situation, but I ended up parring on my provisional.
Yeah.
And bogeying on my not provisional. So now they're like, all right, well, what do you want to take? And I'm like, well, I got to take the five because that's what I think. Like, I don't think I should, that should be OB.
Yeah.
But now in my head, I'm like, crap. At the end of the round, I got to talk to the tournament director and I got to try to talk my way into trying to figure out to make that OB because that'll save me a stroke. Yeah, so I talked to him. I'm like, hey, those OB lines on the back of 17, is that OB for hole 8 as well? And they're like, no, that's just for 17. And I was like, oh, okay.
Dang it.
Well, screw me. But that brings an interesting topic. I don't think that should happen. I think if there's OB, that it needs to be OB for all holes playing around it and not just like...
Well, typically what it is happen. Is like you have course OB. So like there's a barbed wire fence or a property line and you define that like at Independence Park, for instance, in Bedford, there's the entrance gravel road. And so on all holes, it says it at the top of the caddy book when I write it, all holes, gravel road, and beyond's OB. So it doesn't matter where you find it, because it plays in a lot. But then there's some, like hole 13, for instance, which I might actually, that's a pretty bad example, but there's sometimes a hole where it'd be OB on the hole to protect a different fairway, but like that fairway doesn't necessarily need protecting back, if that makes sense, like, or whatever. Yep. So sometimes you put OB just on like hole 4, fence on the right's OB, but then on the other side of the fence, you know, 200 feet farther away is hole 7, so you don't even think about the fence protecting hole 4. And so then you don't put it there. And if you don't put it as an OB for a hole, that's why you have to put like course OB as like all gravel road and beyond's OB for all holes. Because if you forget it on a hole, then it just isn't OB on that hole. So then you might have a player playing over a property line or something, which they're right in the tournament, but you're like, that's my fault as a tournament director. So in your situation, I don't exactly know what that line defined, but if it's something where it sounds like it's just something where they didn't expect a shot to get there.
It defined the back of hole 17. So like 15 feet behind hole 17's basket was OB.
Yeah.
And it was like 15 posts. And the posts, they just had them keep going left out into the field. And that field was like, you know, 500 feet straight off of hole 8's tee pad.
Yeah.
But like I said, most people that play hole 8 just throw a forehand chipper 300 feet and then throw like, it's shaped like an L.
Yeah.
So they just throw a forehand chipper 300 feet straight and then shoot one straight across the other direction. Yeah. So
the tee was probably like, how on earth did you even get there?
Correct. No, there's no way a shot should ever go that direction. But that being said, I was thinking for, you know, all courses in the future, any OB for a hole should be OB. That should be an OB line for every hole.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably very few. It'd probably be easier and safer to have to declare the opposite of what we have to declare now. Like declare the line on hole 4 is not OB on hole 5. Versus having to say like
you're probably doing a lot less work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because like realistically, most OB lines are like protecting a fairway from one another or something, or just like defining a line in general in like a field to make a hole harder or whatever it may be. To where if there is another hole that you're like, there's no way a player does it. If a player did it, that's another thing you learn. Like people learn TDing events. It's happened to me many times. I've like the first few tournaments I ran, I was like, okay, I don't need to put this in the caddy book because there's no chance a shot goes there. Like there's no chance that happened. It will always happen. Somehow a player will do something where you're like, how on earth did you land on the roof of that shed? Like that is so far out of the way of everything. How are you there? But they are. And you're like, okay. So then anytime you're writing a caddy book, you have to define every little thing, even the things that like people will read and be like, what do you like? Why is that even in the caddy book? That's so far out of the way. But it's like, it's because it will happen if you don't put it in the caddy book. So it'd probably be easier to do the opposite where you just define what's not there. But talk, I got to hear really quick the biggest topic that's come out of Music City is the time issue. Again, it's just because Nico was playing very well. So Nico was on feature card. He's focused. He's dialed in.
It's not just Nico.
It's just Nico who keeps getting seen is the thing.
Correct.
And so
it's not just Nico.
No, but that's what I'm asking as a player. A, you already answered question A, which is it something that you're experiencing even if you're not on a feature or lead car where there's other players taking beyond 30 seconds?
Yes.
B, it also sounds like you're answering B, which is it something that bothers players as much as it bothers fans at home? So then that leaves us with question C, what the heck do we do about it?
Okay. Before we jump into that, I do want to say, because it's in the title, so it'd be bad for me not to talk real quick about this. Chris Dickerson's very good at disc golf.
Yes.
I got paid out in Waffle House today, so shout out to Ezra for being a man of his word. And while we were there, we were talking, and he obviously played on lead card with him, and he was like, Chris Dickerson throws very far. And I don't think people realize just how far Chris Dickerson throws.
He's one of those players where you just don't know.
Yeah. And me and Ez were talking about how this offseason we are going to try to incorporate a run-up similar to Chris Dickerson's. Because if you watch me and Ezra throw, there's a couple other people that have like that slow cadence. of where we just take like a couple steps and we're, you know, we might be moving like 3 miles per hour laterally, where Dickerson's probably closer to like 10 miles per hour when he's like really ripping them. So that like extra 7 miles per hour, that if you can get your timing and everything like that, I mean, that's going to generate more distance for you. So yeah,
that's the key though, the timing. That's why most people are recommended to go slow, because timing's more important up front and then speed up once you get the timing. But yeah,
for sure. So, but yeah, I mean, he is ridiculously good. He's the type of player that it doesn't matter what course it is. If he's playing well, he's going to be contending to win. And I didn't get to see a lot of him play, but I did see some of his shots, and he just carved up that course.
Yeah.
And
he to this day still has, I've told this story who knows how many times, but to this day, the most impressive shot I've ever seen thrown with a frisbee was by Chris Dickerson at like a local B tier. He just threw the most insane roller of all time. That it was back when he was like playing local Nashville tournaments when he'd show up here. And it was one of those moments where you're just like, I couldn't fathom doing something like that with a disc. And it's just, you know, that like there's some players you watch and you're like, I can imagine myself being capable of what they just did. And then Dickerson just has a like imagination with a disc to be able to do stuff. And it never looks crazy when you're watching him on coverage, but when you watch him in person, he has this imagination to be able to see lines and see things that you're like, I genuinely think there's no chance I could accomplish some of the things he does. But it's just like when you're watching on coverage, he's so calm and collected about it, you don't even notice that you're watching something incredible. But yeah, he's primed to do something incredible this year. He's obviously already won a major in his past. I think he can do it again. And I think it came at a crucial time because most players like you aren't playing the Tallahassee Open. So he's going into a major with a win. Against a relatively solid field. So I think it's a pretty great time to win for him as well.
Yeah. For all you youngsters out there listening, here's a tip for you. Practice on hard wooded courses as much as you can, because that is a skill set that will benefit you more than just throwing in a field all the time. Not saying that you shouldn't throw in the field ever, but if you like grow up like Dickerson, just playing on hard wooded courses, you are going to be able to do kind of what Hunter was just talking about. You're going to be able to see lines, see shots, manipulate your disc in ways because you've had so many reps and you've put yourself in so many weird situations and have figured out how to get out of them. And you'll save a lot of strokes. So Chris Dickerson, spoiler alert, very good at disc golf. All right, so slow play. I was the victim of this twice. Okay. Round one, we had, I want to say, in between a 2 and 3 hole gap between our group and the group in front of us.
Oh, geez.
Positive, never had to wait on a tee pad. Negative, backed up probably a lot of people behind us, and then also just, you know, playing with that kind of rhythm and pace, not ideal.
Very hard. Yeah.
Second round, this is the first time I've ever seen this, and this might be the first time in the history of the tour that this has ever happened. We were waiting every single tee pad like 5 to 10 minutes. Starting on hole 3, so early on, might even been like a little bit on hole 2, and so it's initially you're just like, dude, the people in front of us are playing so slow. Okay, you're like, what the heck? Why are they playing so slow? Then we get to hole 8, and we see Vino limping off, like walking away, and we're like, what the heck? We come to find out, I guess he stepped in a hole. Hopefully he's doing well, but I guess he stepped in a hole and his like ankle ballooned up and he just wasn't able to play. So he DNFs. So now we see, while we're on hole 8, they're on the tee pad of hole 9. We see him walking across our fairway. So now in our head, we're like, oh, well, we're not going to be backed up at all now because they only have 3 people.
Yeah.
Like they should play a lot faster now. Still backed up. We're like, what? So we're like, what is going on? Who's in this group that is playing incredibly slow? So then we get to hole 14. Another person on their card DNF'd.
What on earth?
They have a 2 DNF'er on one card. I don't know what happened to this person, but now they're at 2. And we come to figure out that it wasn't them, because at this point they're playing as a twosome with like a
marshal,
like a marshal has come out kind of thing. And we're still waiting on them. And we see finally the group in front of them. And we're like, oh my gosh, the group in front of them that's causing them backups, that's backing us up. But it was wild. Like the whole experience was wild to see like a 2 DNF situation and then to still have backups. But that was 2 of my rounds. And you start doing math in your head of just like how fast disc golf should be. Because putting in disc golf is extremely fast.
Mm-hmm.
99% of the time, when you step up to a putt inside of the circle, it is the same exact putt as every time you've thrown that putt.
Yeah.
Very, very rare occasions will you have a tree in your way, will you have to like straddle, do something weird inside a circle. So when you step up to that 27-foot putt, I feel like it should be like a free throw of where you have some sort of 5 to 10 second routine. 10 feels very long, by the way. If you step up to your putt and stay there for 10 seconds, like time yourself, 10 seconds seems very long. But have some sort of routine and then you putt and then that's it, right? Now, obviously, when it's windy, things are going to change. But when the variables are normal, to me, it seems like putting should be very quick. Then when you factor in the fact that a lot of these courses are like par 64, 61, 65, we're really not throwing that many shots, right? We're really throwing a lot of tee shots and then putting and then getting out.
Yeah.
And when you look at the number of shots that we're throwing compared to how long it takes us to play the round, it's not great. So and again, I think when it comes to like viewership on coverage, I don't think it's going to matter. I don't think people are going to be able to really pay attention, because when there are enough cameras out there, you're not going to be just glued in to like what happened this past weekend where you're just glued into the final card.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, you're just sitting there waiting for Nico or waiting for whoever to putt or to throw whatever. Like, it's okay to see Nico's lining up his putt and show something else. If Nico ends up putting while you're showing something else, you should be able to just quickly show what happened. And not even acting like, oh, well, this happened earlier on. Literally, if it happened 5 seconds ago, no one watching is going to know that it happened 5 seconds ago.
Yeah.
So just show it as if it was live and you're good to go. So I think this isn't going to be an issue on coverage in the future. But as a spectator, I know as a player, it annoys everyone. There's not a single person out there that says, you know what? I know today, guys, we can play this round in 3 hours. But why not make it three hours and 45 minutes? Like, there's not a single person that is like, yeah, 3 hours and 45 minutes. Let's do it. So I know players hate slow play. I'm assuming, and this is maybe Silas, you can kind of get a little gauge right now while we have the live chat up. You can get a little gauge of how people are, you know, in the live chat are commenting. Like, I'm assuming if you're at the event spectating, I got to imagine that you're not enjoying the slow play, because nothing, that's the other thing. Nothing's like happening, where if I go to a golf tournament, a lot of times the golfers will take 30, 45 seconds, a minute before they hit a shot, but they're standing with a caddy. You can see them talking. They're throwing the grass up. They're picking up different clubs. They're practice swinging. They're doing a bunch of things, where at least like as I'm spectating it, I can like see and there's be like, oh, that's watch. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what everybody's saying in the chat. Like, I mean, no one likes it. Because you're just sitting there waiting for someone to putt. It's not like they're doing anything else. There's nothing else to watch. You're just even, watching them line up the putt for 30 even, seconds or whatever.
I will even say, like, I will get goosebumps sometimes watching Tiger stalk a putt, right? Like when he's laser focused, he's crouched down behind it. He stands up, he walks around, looks at it from the side, looks at it from the other side, comes back behind it. And he's just like, you can just see the intensity and he's reading the green. Like I'm locked in.
Yeah.
Because that to me, like I can see him doing something. I can see him focusing. He's walking around, you know, he's trying to read the green. The announcers are talking about how hard of a putt this is. When someone's just standing over a 30. For our listeners, I was literally just pump faking. There's nothing there. And I think too, like I'm again, there are so many shots in disc golf that are just the same exact shot. If I step up to a shot, I range find the basket, I'm 200 feet in a wide open field, nothing in my way. Like I should be able to execute that shot in the next 15 seconds. So I think that is where it's weird is where, and then also there's other times too. Like I played with someone that there was just a lot of time wasted where it's like, if you're third on the tee, right? If you're third on the tee, you should be figuring out what you're doing while the first two guys are going. Not once the second guy is off. Now you're like, oh, it's me. And you're like, oh, and you're like getting up and you're like, oh, I gotta drop my hands. And like, how far is it? Like, what are we doing? So there's like so much wasted time that can be had. And also if you are a slow player out there, the last thing people want to see is you be the last person off the tee pad and like 50 feet behind the people you're playing with. And this like sauntering up the fairway. I don't know. Again, I don't really care as much as a player. I feel like, and from the comments I'm seeing on social media, every time someone sees a slow player, and yes, Nico is a slow player. There are other slow players as well out on tour. He's not the only one. And I feel like until something is done, I think it's going to be an issue because you're just going to get more and more people to play slow.
Yeah. Because, I mean, realistically, like for some players, that's an advantage.
I was going to say, do you think that's intentional? Do you think he's doing that on purpose?
No. Nico knows. Nico, I've talked to Nico. Nico knows that he doesn't play fast, and it's something that he doesn't like. I know that for a fact. It's not like he enjoys playing slow. So I don't know what it is with him. Gannon Burr is another person that I talked about last year as someone that plays slow. He also got criticized multiple times when he was featured on, I believe, like Waco. When he was featured on Waco live coverage, people were talking about him playing slow, and he saw that, and that was, I think he even made a post on social media talking about how he's worked on playing quicker, putting faster, doing all those things.
Yeah. Like you were saying too, with the slow play, I think that it's partially when it's happening on every shot that it becomes an issue, because like if it's a big moment and a player who normally is taking 10, 15 seconds on a putt takes 30 because the wind's up and they're like drying their hand off and you can see their focus.
Or they're second guessing themselves because of the pressure.
And you can feel the moment. That's one thing. I normally don't see complaints because that 30 seconds goes by fast because you're focused with the player. The other thing too that makes it go by quick is when you take it and you're in the middle of the fairway or like middle of the hole, but you're off the fairway. And a player gets up to their lie, they're looking, and then they walk out into the fairway, they look down the fairway, they pick out their gap, they go back in, they range find, they're chalking their hand, then they line up, and then once they line up, they throw within like 10, 15 seconds. But when you put the whole thing together from when they first address their lie to the disc coming out of their hand, it might be a minute.
That's fine.
But because, like you were saying, because there's a lot happening and they're studying, it's not just a run-of-the-mill shot. They're like, I've never been here before. Correct. I got to figure this out. It, again, doesn't feel bad. I think the issue and why Nico gets called out by social media so much on it is a lot of times it is just a 25-foot putt, and Nico's good enough that he's on coverage regularly.
Correct.
That's the biggest issue.
That is the key. Nico is good enough to where he actually has cameras on it.
Yeah, and the thing too is like, Nico, what sucks in my head for Nico?
Because there was someone, I don't know who it was.
Yeah.
But there was someone, that round two, there was someone two cards ahead of me. I don't know if I can go back and see who that, like who was on that card, but there was someone two cards ahead of me that was, someone was playing incredibly slow.
Yeah.
I don't know who it was.
Yeah.
So it's like there are so many people, and until something happens about it, because right now we've seen that for the most part, players coming out and saying like we don't like it, spectators coming out and saying we don't like it, doesn't change the behavior, right?
Yeah,
so there needs to be something else.
Nico got warned at this tournament. But I don't think he got a stroke. I don't think he got a second warning.
Correct. That's what I heard as well.
Yeah. So now, something was said, but not twice.
Now you can. This is where it's tough, right? Because again, I don't like playing slow, but at the same time, I know that if I say something to the person that's playing slow, like buddy, you got to speed it up, man. You're playing way too slow.
Yeah.
I now am potentially jeopardizing the entire situation of the card.
Yeah.
The rest of the way. And you've seen me playing rounds with some people that when they don't play well, they make everyone's life miserable. A living hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of where it's just like you, even if you're playing well, you're like, this is not fun to be around because this person is just like, making, yeah, you've seen it.
Yeah.
So the thought of like you now are potentially doing something to make that happen, it is not a pleasant thing. And I know there are some pros out there that are like, bro, if you guys hate slow play, just freaking say something about it. Like, it's not that easy though. That's the problem, is like, when you start bringing it up to people, and again, it's like, what are you going to do? You're just going to keep stroking them every single time it happens, and then they're just going to hate you. And then now it's like, I'm going to have to see this person next week and the week after that. I think for a lot of people, it makes very awkward situations. And even we see it all the time. We see it all the time of where like a disc is like somewhat in and out. Like we just saw it at Texas State's. Where I don't know who it was. Who was it that threw that shot on hole 17 and it was like caught in the tree over the fence? And they were like, Big Germ was on the card. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
I don't know if I saw that situation.
The disc was like floating in the air and there was a barbed wire fence underneath it for OB. And so like, the disc was like a good like 3 feet above the barbed wire fence, and they were trying to figure out like, is that in or is that out? Like, that is just a very awkward conversation to have a lot of times, to be like, oh no, you're definitely out, dude.
Yeah.
And then be like, no, I'm not. I think I'm in. And be like, no, man, you're out. So this, ready? This is how you avoid it.
All right, let's hear it.
You invest in a golf cart. You have someone that knows the rules sit in a golf cart with a walkie-talkie. You have someone at headquarters, HQ, or whatever, that also has a walkie-talkie. And because I'm pretty sure, too, like there's like a number situation or something, because the two DNF situation where they're like, what do we do? We have two people that DNF. We can't keep playing.
Yeah.
There was a number that they called to get in contact with someone. So you have that number at HQ. And so that way that person can walkie-talkie to the person on the golf cart. Hey, there's an issue on hole 8. Can you get out there?
Yeah.
Because that person, the golf cart person also, when they don't have an issue to zip around to, they're also just meandering about, right? They're just driving about. And guess what? If they were driving about and they saw our situation round one and they saw that there was a 2-hole gap in between our card and the next card, all they would do is zip over and say, hey guys, you're on the clock. I'm giving you a couple holes to catch up with the group in front of you.
Yeah.
If you don't, I'm going to stroke you all. So now it's on all of us.
Yeah.
So now everyone is like, I have to play a little bit quicker. I have to walk a little bit faster to the next tee pad. I need to throw my shot and immediately start walking. And that's how you solve it. You solve it with just having a golf cart and a marshal, and 90% of these courses, you can zip around real quick in a golf cart and get from hole to hole. No problem. The wooded holes, wooded courses, that might be a little bit trickier.
Then you just get a one wheel, ride the trails.
You get a one wheeler. That could work.
Boom. Connor just gets on his one wheel and he just cruises around the course. The win-win. He's having a great time. The players have someone to talk to. Win-win.
But I think we've seen it enough times where pros are just not interested. That conversation is just such a, like, it's one thing to call a disc in or out. It's another thing to call like, hey man, you're in circle one. You can't step putt here. Like, it's another thing to say like, yo man, you're playing slow.
Yeah.
You need to play faster.
Yeah, it's one thing when you're judging like a disc or a lie or something like that versus when you're judging how a player is actually playing the event.
It's the same thing. You never want to be the person of where like everyone sees a disc travel and then they lose it behind a tree, right? And so you don't see it land and you get up there to try to look for it. No one wants to be that guy as soon as you start looking for it, being like, all right, you're on the clock. 3 minutes has started.
Yeah.
No one wants to be that guy. There's always that weird time limit of like, all right, we've been looking for like a minute.
Yeah, we need it. To start the timer.
We need to start the time. Like, there's always that weird time of where the majority of pros aren't going to be like, oh, 3 minutes, start. Here we go. Good luck finding your disc.
Yeah.
So I think that's the only solution. I think the only solution is to have some sort of marshal, have some sort of, you know, PDGA official zip around on a golf cart. And again, like that also just knowing it, that as players, we should be able to see like, hey, we just finished this hole and we're walking to the next tee pad and they're off the hole already. We need to play this hole quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also gives you a better talking point of just being like, hey guys, the group in front of us is 2 holes ahead. Like, I don't want the marshal to come stroke us. We should probably pick it up to where you can talk to the whole card instead of talking to, hey, Silas, right, you're taking 45 seconds every putt, man. Keep it up. I might have to stroke you. Like, it's a lot less awkward if you're addressing the hole.
Like, hey, Silas, can you stop 5-putting every hole?
Yeah.
It's taking forever.
Yeah.
Can you please just 3-putt so we can move on?
Yeah. Now, then you can just address the whole card. So then all of us are like, oh, okay. We know what you're talking about, but you don't have to make it awkward. Now, I think it's been a big enough issue for long enough that something has to be done. It's at some point soon. And I'm assuming the Pro Tour already knows that, because the other issue is when you do have a player that's slow, whoever it is on coverage, it irritates players or irritates fans to where fans now don't want to watch live coverage.
I hate that.
An issue overall, because for disc golf, like, you got post-produced that cuts it out. But for the Disc Golf Network, the Disc Golf Pro Tour as a business, they want those subscribers. So if you have people who are like, watching the final day and they're like, why on earth would I subscribe to this? Like, I'm watching a guy, whoever it may be, line up for a putt for 50 seconds. This is awful. I'd rather just watch, and rightfully so, I'd rather just watch the cut together version. That's not a good business model either. So they got financial interest in solving it as well, because it's not just some people are a little unhappy, but you know, it is what it is. Deal with it. There's money on the line that's being lost by not addressing it right now.
Yeah, it's a crazy reoccurring theme, right? You like, yeah. I feel like we've talked about this multiple times, multiple weeks, and you know, it honestly probably wouldn't have the limelight if some of the better players didn't play slow, because you'd never see them.
That's what I was gonna say earlier before we kind of kept talking about it. Was what sucks for Nico. And some of it's somewhat brought on himself, but what sucks for him is when I was first getting into the sport, when Trevor's first getting into the sport, Nico, at that time, very little controversy surrounded him. He was just the best player on earth, basically, at that time. Mm-hmm. When I got into the sport, Paul had eclipsed him, but like 2009, 2012, that range, it was like him and Shoestrick. And that's what that's what Nico was. We are now 13 years later, and Nico is still relevant enough to be arguably a top five, definitely a top 10 player. Like, he has this career that the longevity of it is among the Paul, Ricky, you know, that type of caliber player, but it's just being overshadowed in this generation by all these different reoccurring issues, where it's like, yes, they're self-inflicted issues, but on the flip side of the coin, it kind of sucks because like people are missing out at how good of a player Nico is because you get so focused on him taking a minute to pull the trigger on a putt sometimes. So
he's actually been playing ridiculously well.
That's what I'm saying. Is that's why it seems like such a prevalent issue is he's good enough to be on coverage this much. Like if he sucked and he was not on coverage, you wouldn't hear a thing about it because you don't know, like the card in front of you that this weekend. Until you said it,
no one has any idea who that is.
We didn't know. Yeah, we still don't know who it was.
That's the thing. I want to know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like we have no idea who that was, but they're causing the same exact type issue as Nico. It's just Nico's on lead card. They weren't. That's the difference. But it's
a
field wide issue.
This is too like also where I still feel like I have a lot of years left of playing on the tour. But I am very looking forward to being done because I do feel like it frees me up a little bit, right? Because it's like, again, like I'm very cordial and friendly with Nico. I've never had any qualms or issues with him. Same thing with Gannon and some of these other guys too. And it's like, you know, sometimes these hot topics come up and these players are in those hot topics. A lot of times I'm in the hot topic as well. So it makes it, you know, it makes it kind of more awkward to kind of have these conversations sometimes. Because then it's like, all right, well, I'm probably going to see this guy.
Tomorrow. And they're going to have just heard what you said. Now you got to address it.
Practicing. But for the most part, I try to be at least open to people, talk to them too. But obviously people want to hear what I have to say on certain issues. And so, yeah, it is what it is. It sucks that it's always Nico.
Yeah.
But that's because he's putting himself in that position to where it is, where people think he is the only perpetrator. Is that the right word?
Perpetrator.
When in fact, he clearly is not.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I've got some voice memos queued up.
Did Saz ever get the scuba guy? Did you ever figure that out? The scuba guy?
I did not see it come across. I saw where there was one that was supposed to be submitted, but I didn't see one come across since that time.
Someone tweeted saying, like, I need to call in to talk to you about the scuba.
Yeah. So maybe we'll have it next week. Maybe we'll have it next week. I'm going to play some of these. I have two voice memos queued up. Honestly, I don't remember the first one. But
that tree was in my way.
Yeah.
Everyone out there.
The angle did not do you favors. It looked like you just decided to throw the scuba in a wide open field.
No. I had a tree in direct line to the basket. So for that scuba probably curved 7 to 8 feet around the tree. And I will. Whew, do I dare? I feel like I dare. Do I dare? I dare. From 60 feet with an obstacle in your way to where you can only throw an anti-putt, like you have to throw something left to right. I like my odds against everyone on tour.
Ooh. Interesting. I don't know what that turns into, but I don't know if I agree with you. Just I haven't seen it enough.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know how confident I am. That's why I was trying to think in my head. But I think
some players make some sick Annie putts, but it's a very unique situation that you are in where you need to go like high floaty Annie or scuba. Yeah, I've adopted the scuba to where Annie putts are one of my favorite things to throw, but there's some situations where the scuba genuinely makes more sense. Where just you look at it and you're like, I could throw this Annie putt, but the scuba gives me a much better chance of it going in.
I think for me to have a better chance too, you would have to putt everything out. So that way.
Oh, yeah.
That way you can't just like, you know, I mean, you could if you wanted to, but if you end up throwing hard Annie putt around and you miss and it, you know, rolls and does whatever, you still have to putt from there. So it's total putts, like 20 attempts from 60 feet, an object like in your way to where you have to like probably throw a 5 to 6 foot Annie left to right. And you got to putt everything out. And we take the total number of putts from there. I like my chances.
That'd be fast.
That'd be a fun little one.
That'd be a fun challenge. Yeah. So we're going to play these voice memos. And while we're doing that, let's be sure to be putting in the chat if you have any debate topics or questions or whatever you want to be brought up. Silas will be going through the chat and bringing those up. We'll get a few answered here after these two voice memos as well. So let me get this first one here queued up.
Hey, shout out to all the members of the Hyzer Club, too. Our Patreon numbers are going up, up, up. So if you are a member of the Hyzer Club, shout out to you. Thank you for supporting Foundation Disc Golf.
We should have the first thing that the Hyzer Club, I believe it's Elite or Hall of Fame, I think maybe Hall of Fame, gets early access to here in a few weeks. So that'll be exciting.
Yeah. And we also got some stuff added.
Yeah, we just got some new minis, I believe, added today. They don't even know about that yet. But if you're a Hyzer Club member,
heck yeah,
over on the Hyzer Club store, I forgot to post about it. But thanks for reminding me.
Wasn't I supposed to say that?
No, that was fair game. They're up.
Oh, okay.
But let's hear this. That's great promotion. Yeah, great job, Silas. All right, Travis. This is from Travis. He left us a voice message. If you want to leave a voice message, you can head over to fdnsports.com. Hit podcast in the debate night tab. There's a little thing there you can leave voice memo if you want a chance for us to hear your take on something. But again, this is from Travis. Is it ready, Silas? Yeah. All right.
Howdy, guys. This is Travis from College Station. One thing I wanted to bring up was I honestly think that the Pro Tour needs to get away from where USDGC is and that whole concept right now. Not saying they need to get rid of like the US championships, but for someone like me, I started kind of around when Brody started. I started like February or so of that 2020. And I've never watched USDGC. I watched the final round last year because it was free on YouTube. But if you think about the bump in subscribers that we've had, both to the network and just members of the PDGA in that past few years, I know y'all talk a lot about the prestige of the event. To us, there really isn't that prestige because we've only been around for a few years. I wouldn't say most, but a lot of people have only been around for a few years at this point. And I think it's only going to get worse with regards to INOVA being in control of a Pro Tour major and then having to deal with a course that's at a college campus. Watching the final round last year, yes, it's exciting, but I do think it is weird seeing the hole where you throw from the Coliseum, basically. You're basically on like the steps of another building, and there's people, you know, you're throwing around batting, baseball fields and stuff like that. I think we need to work on getting away from that event probably as soon as we can, because the problem now is that there's not that prestige for a lot of people, so you can move it. But if you wait another 5-6 years, well, now there's going to be that prestige to the event. Now it's going to be harder to move, and more fans are going to be upset about moving it later than if you move it now.
So there you have it. Fascinating points brought up by Travis. Mainly the reason I picked that is because I am one of the people who is like suckered into the prestige of USDGC. And Trevor brought it up. I don't remember if it was on Griplocked or we just were having a conversation after Griplocked one day. But Trevor brought it up. He goes, what's funny to me is, if USDGC was a brand new tournament this year, he's like, Hunter, you and I would hate it. We would come after it because of the way the course is, where the course is at, and like so much about the like course design and stuff like that. But because it has history, we like are in love with it. And I was like, that's a great point. And then the side point he also made is the subscription model of how you have to watch it. Obviously, this year they've switched it up. If you're a Disc Golf Network subscriber at all, you'll be able to watch it. But over the past few years, that hasn't been true. So if you're a new player to the sport, I can fully see where USDGC, to me and to other players, you know, that started around the same time as me or before me, it is the like most prestigious event. And to a lot of players on tour, it is like the most elite title. But I wanted to hear your opinion now too, Brody, as being a new player who has now played USDGC. Did it feel special to you, or did it just feel like
no.
another event and you're like, why am I throwing from a basketball stadium?
W.R. Jackson feels special.
Yeah.
That course doesn't feel special.
Yeah, so he might be onto something, that change is inevitable at USDGC. We've talked about that multiple times. The course can't be there forever. I think Innova's aware of that. We've also talked about multiple times how it's an issue that Innova or US Disc Golf has USDGC trademarked, to where the PDGA, I mean, doesn't really have that much control. But if there is ever a time to move it and to make adjustments, it is probably in the next year or two. Because as much as that would suck, I think it would probably be for the better of the event.
I mean, you just got to try your best to try to find courses that feel like disc golf is the priority.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Because
which looking, that
his points are valid. Like when you're watching, you're like, you're throwing from buildings, you're throwing around baseball fields. Yeah, it doesn't feel as special as if, you know, I will say at MCO that was the benefit of the course, is you're just out there. It's just a disc golf course. There's nothing else out there.
Yeah. Now I got to ask you about, because you just brought up W.R. Jackson feeling special, and I 100% agree. I think it's a course that should be used very frequently on the pro tour / major circuit. But one thing I noticed was, if you look at the ticket sales, the pre-sales for tickets and the online sales for tickets, they're only 400 spots a day. Now, yeah. I don't know if that's something where they're going to open up more, but I know a big issue with this park is the parking in general.
There's no parking.
Yeah, so typically what they've done in the past is like players park at the course, and then you're parking kind of along the road or farther up and either being shuttled in
where,
or having a long
where
walk.
Are we parking at the course? There's in like 40 of, spots.
Mm-hmm.
There's 40 spots.
And up the there's a parking lot if you go farther down. I think it's a boat ramp. Past the course, I believe, and then they were running shuttles. So like where you turn left to be turning into the PDGA headquarters, you keep going.
Because I think everything in front of the building is just going to be like staff parking. But yeah, the parking there is not great. And the other thing is like maximum 100 people per hole.
Yeah, but that's what's fascinating. Maybe. Is like we're at a point in disc golf where limiting a major gallery to 400 people, it just seems crazy to me. Like that doesn't seem. I don't know.
Are they sold out? Are they sold out?
I don't know. Not all of them. Not all of them. But
they're not sold out. Then, okay. Yeah. 20, but if they don't sell out, they don't sell out.
Then yes.
It's like
correct.
You don't have an issue.
Correct. But thinking back to 2018 Worlds, I believe was there. It was obviously, I believe, free to attend. There had to be more than 400 spectators when I'm thinking back to it. Maybe it was just at the fort.
I have a hard time believing we're going to go to any tour event and there's going to be less than 400 people that want to go.
That's what I'm saying.
I have a hard time.
So that's where
I feel
I'm
like
just,
the numbers being closer shocked. And closer to 1,000.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that there's a major with only 400 players, because like I think that's something that's going to have to be taken into account. The bigger and bigger the sport gets, is like majors need to be strategic of big time disc golf areas, or at least bigger cities that can support, you know, everything the pro tour is bringing in, because that's a big revenue generator. Like if a major came to Lynchburg, great, that's sick. We're not going to be able to field nearly as many spectators is if a major went to Charlotte. And so for the Pro Tour, it should be a lot more attractive for that major to go to Charlotte, regardless of if the course is better in Lynchburg than in Charlotte. I'm not taking a shot at Charlotte courses. I'm just saying locations. Please don't come after
everything.
That. But you got to look at stuff like that.
Everything has to be considered.
Yes.
It's not just how good is the course. It's literally everything else. MCO, like the course wasn't, in my opinion, like wasn't at pro level just yet, but they have incredible amount of land there. So they can make that course pro level.
Yeah.
Not hard to do. Parking was great. I think they had food shuttles out there. Plentiful space for spectators to watch. Really good spots too, where you could stand and see like four different holes. So like as a whole, that course, like that event has everything you need for a disc golf pro tour event. It's tough when you start looking at a course like WR Jackson, because I was talking about this earlier. This is the first course that we've played this season that I'm actually excited to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that good.
Yeah.
It's that fun.
Of course, it's incredible.
It's that fun to play. And so that's where it's tough, because it is such a good course, but it's like, how the heck are you, like, how, if disc golf continues to grow, how are you going to have 5,000 people on this course?
Yeah. You can't.
You're not. It's impossible. So like, are you wanting to limit yourself to be like, well, the course is so good though. Or is there, I don't know, can you do like some sort of like avatar thing where you put like rainforest walkways up in the trees?
Hey, there you go. There's some ideas. What about just helicopter tours?
What?
Everyone's in helicopters.
What? No, what about rope swings? And you can just rope swing from platform to platform.
Now we're talking. Zip lines all over the course.
Just Rainforest Cafe the whole course out. Everyone's up in the tree balconies. Get some ambiance up there with some monkey noises.
You know, if disc golf had some like crazy budgets, doing like tree houses with bridges between, where you like
incredible.
Show up to a tree house and like that's like
incredible.
The bar with snacks and stuff like that. You're sitting up there watching the 18th green.
Incredible.
I mean, that could be, we're talking years from now. That's the future.
How's that years from now? People put tree houses in their backyards all the time.
Because the tree house has to be regulated to fit like 50 people. We're talking a tree clubhouse. We're talking like treehouse masters from Animal Planet coming out.
Like, yeah, it might as well be a building.
Yeah, it's just a building and a tree, and like five trees are supporting this clubhouse.
Get five dads and they'll knock it out on a weekend. No problem.
And then just bridges. I mean,
tons of bridges.
Courses that have like, you know, Waco, where it has like wooded stretches. If that's like a disc golf, only a disc golf park, you like get to the wooden stretches and the spectators go up the stairs. And they're elevated on bridges, so they can watch the wooden sections and come back out.
And they're in like the aquarium glass, so that way if like a spray, you know, someone sprays it off the tee, it just slams in the glass, and no one can get hurt.
Boom!
That's awesome.
Yeah, we just solved
incredible.
It. There you go. That's how you keep your wooden courses around. Solved by debate.
I really wish we were making thumbnails for this podcast, like not just our faces, because like that.
A clip. Silas will clip that.
I know, but if we could like Photoshop, well, maybe that's what we need, Silas. Maybe we need thumbnails for the clips, because like in my head, I'm thinking like you get like a shot of me throwing in a wooded course, but then you like Photoshop up like tree houses.
Oh, I'll make all it happen,
all in the trees. And like that thumbnail is like, oh gosh, that'd be sweet.
All right.
All right.
It'll be in by tomorrow, boss.
Perfect. I love it.
This next one's a long message. I'm only going to play the first cue and then I'm going to pause it, because he brought up six debate topics and then answered all six. But it's all on one hypothetical situation. It's also going to be a little quiet, Silas. So just a heads up. All right, let's play this thing.
Six debate topics?
Hello, Debate Night. Oh, I have a hypothetical for you tonight that I think would cause multiple debate topics. So here we go. Let's say in 6 months there will be a hybrid four-round disc golf slash golf tournament, 2 rounds at Northwoods Black and 2 rounds at Bethpage Black, and it will be set up as if it's a major championship. Let's suspend reality and assume they are close enough together for this to be feasible. Using this year's Players Championship as a reference, there will be a $20 million prize pool, with $3.6 million going to the first and the top 65 making the cut. There would also be some sort of qualifying with 144 spots available. Debate item one. Who would win? A PGA Tour pro, a disc golf touring pro, some dark horse athlete?
All right, that's where we're pausing it, because that's, I think, the biggest debate topic. You have Northwoods Black, hardest disc golf course, Bethpage Black, obviously very hard golf course. Who's winning a two-round on each course hybrid event? You don't have to say a person, but we'll just start with category. Is it a PGA pro or is it a disc golfer?
I love these topics, though, because it feels like a lot of people are starting to talk about this stuff, of where it's like they just want to I don't even know. It's the classic thing of where guys just like talk all the time about sports. It's like, oh, like we had a guy on our ultimate frisbee team that swore he was athletic, but he wasn't like an insane athlete. He didn't play football at all, but he swore that the SEC offensive linemen are so good that if he just got 30 touches a game, that he was going to get 100 yards. He would average 100 yards a game in the SEC as a running back, as long as he just got 30 touches. And we were like, are you insane? And then another guy on our team.
I mean, that's not that outlandish of a take. I can understand that.
That is outlandish. You wouldn't even make it through the whole game.
He's saying the gaps. Like, he's saying, like, the gaps are so big in the SEC that you just run through
them. They aren't, though. Through arm tackles. No, you're as soon as someone gets their paw on you, where
it's not my take. SEC, I'm just saying that doesn't sound that crazy.
You said it now.
That doesn't sound that crazy.
It is. You're ridiculous to think that. And then another guy was like talking about how he thought that we, as an ultimate frisbee team, could manage to put together a squad that could beat the women's Florida volleyball team, which was like a top five program
in volleyball.
And I'm like, you're insane.
See, that one's no.
Some people are just great, but it is a thing, like the Luke Humphreys thing and the Drew Gibson thing. A lot of people are like, sorry. And I think it's a classic thing that you see people talk about a lot of times to their friends. I think this is the first time that at least that I've seen since I've gone to disc golf, where I've seen like disc golf pros like voice their opinion about them being able to do other sports as well. So it brings up fun topics. And this is definitely an interesting one.
Well, who do you think? Do you think a disc golfer is winning, or do you think a PGA Tour golfer is winning?
So the way I look at it is, if you look at some of the people that play on tour, right, that aren't the greatest disc golfers, to see how far of a gap they are from the pros in disc golf and golf, right? This is what I think, though. I think when you go into a wooded course like that, man, I think it might be a disc golfer.
I would agree.
Because in golf, you're using equipment. You're using a piece of equipment first off, I don't think there's any professional golfers that are incredibly.
I do believe Bryson.
A lot of times,
Bryson DeChambeau, I believe, plays disc golf. I don't think he plays it actively, like regularly, but
did he throw a shot?
I've heard that he plays a disc.
Did he throw a frisbee in that Dude Perfect video?
I'm not sure. But those frisbees look so flippy that you can't tell anything about them.
Well, those are Ultra Stars, dude. They look
worse. No, they look worse than Ultra Stars. They look like Whammo. Every time they throw them, they put them on Heiser and those things roll. But there's a picture of Bryson at a disc golf course once. Someone took a selfie with him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
So, my whole idea of why I think a disc golfer wins is mainly because there's enough disc golfers that have played golf before and are competent at golf that they could, what they would score at Bethpage Black, where it would be horrendous. If you put someone who's never played disc golf at Northwoods Black, they're shooting worse than 100. Because it's not only distance, but you also have to be accurate at Northwoods Black.
Because the thing is, if the main thing, I think I would pick if it was like a, let's say it was like Preserve, right? Yeah. Like an open course. I think I'm picking golf.
Yes.
Because the golfer is going to continue to be able to advance the disc forward.
Yeah.
At Bethpage Black, there are going to be holes where they're only advancing the disc like 30 feet.
Yeah.
And in golf, I think because of the course situation, I think in that scenario, I'm going with the disc golfer.
Yeah. All right, there you have it. I would agree. I was hoping you were going to say a golfer because I was like, this would be a great debate topic because I'm pretty confident on the two courses a disc golfer would win. But I agree. If it's an open course like Preserve or something like that, where, because you also have to think, like, there's a chance a disc golfer playing golf just tops a ball and it doesn't go anywhere. Whereas, like, in disc golf, it's of a wide open course, the disc is advancing forward.
Yeah, that's not happening. Like,
but in Northwoods Black, I've played that course, the disc isn't always advancing forward.
In that scenario, too, like, I would really like my chances if I was going up against, like, a top five golfer, I would really like my chances a lot because I think it'd be a lot harder to beat them if we were playing on like more of a pitch and putt style. Yeah.
Now, obviously if this was a real event with $20 million on the line, you're known about a long time in advance. So then disc golfers are going to be practicing a lot more golf and golfers are going to learn how to play disc golf. So then at that point, it just becomes the best athlete wins, essentially.
If you're telling me that golfers have time to train both, then I'm picking a golfer.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying in the original scenario, there's no time to train. The event's tomorrow. I'm saying, and if this was a true event, it would be like announced a year in advance, and you got a year to because if it's a real event and there's a $20 million purse or like whatever it has to be for golfers to care about the event enough to train for a year, then it just becomes like obviously a golfer is most likely going to win because they've got way more.
The amount of time, you know, in 6 months that they will get better in disc golf will drastically outweigh how much better a disc golfer will get in golf.
Well, it would be a fascinating experiment that I don't think we'll ever have. On this level, to see like someone who is a professional golfer has the, you know, money and trainers allocated to them that golfers do, if they were to fully get into disc golf where they still have the same budget from Nike or their sponsors or whoever, so that they have a dedicated trainer and they can pay someone to be a dedicated swing coach, pretty much the exact same type people they have in golf, how quickly they could actually get to the top with that type of assistance, where you have a trainer, the same person or whoever it may be that's working with them on golf in the gym, is now looking at a disc golf swing and saying, these are the motions we need to work on, these are the motions you need to train, and then you hire a swing coach, like the equivalent of what they have, and it's like, all right, this is what we're doing, and then they just took their regimen that they're doing for golf right now and just copy and paste it into disc golf. That'd be fascinating.
I don't think that would be the, if we were picking sports though, I don't think that would be the sport that I would say would be the best crossover though.
What's the best copy and paste crossover?
I'd probably say tennis or baseball.
Yeah, tennis is a great one. We were actually, The video coming out tomorrow on Foundation Nation. We played against the tennis pro. Well, we won't say how many handicaps we had to give him to make it competitive, but it was shocking how good he was with all the handicaps we gave him still. But at the end, he plays disc golf too. And at the end, he was like talking to us about how similar, like when you break it down, like a tennis backhand and a tennis forehand, how easily you can translate that into disc golf. He's like, obviously there's some things that you have to tweak a little bit. He's like, but it's a really quick thing to pick up because your muscle memory knows a lot of it from tennis already. And I was like, that's a really good point.
But yeah, I think that's why I was quick to learn how to throw a frisbee because of my tennis background.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. All right, Silas, you got a topic or two from the chat?
Topics. Hey, if anyone has any topics.
Silas, I already did the shout out to the chat.
I know,
man.
And no one.
Oh my word.
Everyone just wants to listen. Everyone just wants to take. Well, hey, if you're listening and you're not subscribed yet, make sure you go over to our YouTube. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple, make sure you go over to YouTube. Hit us with a little subscribe action. We're closing in on 20,000 subscribers.
Yeah, there are more scratch golfers than scratch disc golfers.
There's way more golfers than disc golfers.
But that would be incorrect if the handicap system was the same for both.
Mm.
Yeah, because the disc golfer is no longer 1,000, I wouldn't say.
Well,
what,
no.
What do you think it is?
Well, no, hold on. The systems are...
The systems are completely different.
Disc golf gives you an average. So when you shoot a bad score, it drops you down. Golf, your handicap is just if you play well, what you would shoot. Silas, if you go out and shot 10 rounds... and four of them were 950, and the other six were below 900, your rating would be 950.
Oh, okay.
But in disc golf, your rating would actually probably be like 890.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So if the handicap system in golf was the same as disc golf, or vice versa, if the handicap system in golf like took your average, there would be way fewer scratch golfers. Because every time you went out and shot an 88, that would drop your handicap down significantly. In this scenario, going out and shooting 88, you don't get penalized.
Someone's asking if I'll try to break 100 again. We might have to bring that back for the summer. Because I haven't played golf in a solid 3 weeks or so. Might have to bring it back.
Oh, here we go. Anyone not top 25 or with a top tier sponsor should 100%. Oh, never mind.
That's
not a big topic.
Do we want to say anything about the store, Hunter?
Not yet.
You wanna tease that a little bit?
I posted a teaser. There's a video or a picture on our Instagram. If you're not following our Instagram, shameless plug. I posted a little picture. Store's coming. We should have the official date and events surrounding the grand opening announced here in the next week or two. So pretty excited. Not going to lie. Definitely something we've been working towards in the back of our head for a while. Something we knew we wanted down the line. And it's almost here. It's almost a reality. So super excited about that. And there's also a ton of other stuff kind of going on in the works that can't quite say yet. But if they all work out, you know, it could be some really fun stuff.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, it is what it is. We got to catch up.
We're working on finding a content house right now in warm weather. So that's good news.
Also known as Brody's house.
It will be a content house.
Yeah. I mean, content will be made. It will be flowing outside of that house. Someone said this one I can just quickly dispel. Silas, I don't know if you saw it. Millennie Disc Golf said, debate this. No one knows what a disc will fly like until they throw it.
Yeah, I saw that.
Incorrect. But... I mean, I'm not going to claim I can do it every time, but I have watched, I've got to witness firsthand Paul, who I would assume is probably one of the best at feeling discs and saying what they're going to fly like. I've got to be with him when he walked through, this was back when he was with Innova's warehouse, and just, I would hand him a stack of destroyers and be like, I need a stable one out of this. And just pick them up, hold them, pass them to me. No, this is what you want right here.
Wow.
And
okay. Here
it's
we
just
go.
Like once you've played enough disc golf and you felt enough of the same discs, you know what a stable or unstable one feels like. And you can just feel it.
I have no idea.
Yeah. But like I feel like I would bet if I handed you a stack of 10 nukes and you had to guess, you could feel them up and guess.
No.
Soon.
How would I know?
They feel different. It's just like it's a lot about the rim shape and how they settle, but also the plastic, the stiffness of the rim. I feel confident enough that I wouldn't put it on the line like a lot of money, but I feel like I'd be more accurate than inaccurate if I just was handed a disc and had to just tell you how it flew without knowing anything about it.
Oh, here we go.
It.
All right. We got a super chat from D. Lillo. They say, do you think that there will be a saturation point, when it comes to too many disc golf stores? Are so many new online retailers killing the local shops? Boom.
I mean, will there be too much saturation? I think there's too much saturation to where not all the current disc golf stores that are open will exist years from now. But that's that's just a small business thing. Like,
do you think
the majority,
there'll be a franchise?
Yes.
Of disc golf stores?
Yes, 100%.
That's cool.
But the rate that small businesses open and close in the first 5 years is like 75%, maybe even higher. Yeah.
Jeez.
It happens. I mean, small businesses close way more often than they stay open. But I don't think that it's necessarily hurting disc golf. I think the online store to local store, that's the same thing going on in every other industry. It's just two different types of people. And in disc golf, I think what a local store has going for it is there's nothing like walking into a store. And if I go online and I don't know what a Rock 3 feels like, or I'm trying to decide between a Rock 3 and a Buzz, I've heard they fly similar. I've never felt them. I can go online and I can buy both. And I can have them both sent to me. I can go throw them. But then one of the two I'm going to decide I didn't like. Or I can walk into my local disc golf store, talk to a knowledgeable staff, say, hey, what's your opinions on these two discs? What are the differences? And hold them. Feel the plastic. Feel what they feel like in my hand. That's something that no matter how much an online retailer tries, you can't accomplish. So as disc golf continues to get bigger and bigger, there's also the instant gratification on both ends. One side, it's the instant gratification of I didn't have to leave my house to purchase that disc. On the other end, it's the instant gratification of I didn't have to wait 2 days, 3 days, however long it ends up taking for the disc I just bought to come in. So one side, the instant gratification is I walk into a store, I buy that, you know, ESP Vulture, I go straight to the course and throw it. The other one is I'm sitting on the couch, it's 9:30 at night, I'm exhausted, but I'm watching coverage, I see a sick shot, I go on to foundationdisc.com, find the heat I want, buy it, it's coming to my door in a few days. So I think there's pros and cons to each, and I think that the best businesses will stick around when it's all said and done. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of disc golf stores that are open right now that aren't going to be open a few years from now. I think that's very safe to say.
Gotcha. All right. Cool. We got another one. So someone says, with ball golf, you can get fitted with clubs. So do you ever think that people will get discs fitted to them?
Fitted, no. Because like fitting for a club, Brody, you're changing everything about the club.
Okay,
well,
no.
Right?
When I say fitted, I think of like here you're in a field and like there's a bunch of different manufacturers. There's a bunch of different discs, and they're like, hey, like what feels good to you? What fits your play style?
Yeah. So that, I think, we've talked through doing that ourselves, of where you go out in a field, you have bins of discs, and people can try them. But, like, golf fitting's different because, like, a 7-iron from wherever, they have, like, let's just say Titleist. I've never been golf fitted, so I'm probably going to say everything wrong, but I'm going to give Brody a chance to laugh and correct me. But you have a 7-iron from Titleist, and they might have a few different heads, but the biggest thing about the fitting is once you combine the head with the stiffness of the shaft, with the grip you like, then you get maximum performance. Whereas like with a disc, what are you going to change? You're not going to sit there and run like a new mold or something.
Yeah.
Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, you just missed out on Lion Loft. Those also come into play.
Yeah.
But yeah, There's way more things that you can tinker with on the golf side than you can on the disc golf side. But I do think that some players could benefit to going to someone and you saying, okay, throw your max distance shot, throw your straight shot, and have them like throw shots so you can see what they're doing. Because if someone's like, throw your max distance shot, and they just throw a disc like on crazy Annie and it just immediately hyzers out, you can be, and then you say, throw your straight shot, and they throw like a beautiful hyzer flip up to flat. You can be like, hey, if we can get you in this like Nuke SS instead of you throwing this Nuke OS, if you throw that same hyzer flip kind of shot, it'll turn and you'll get a full flight. Like, I think there is something to be said about helping newer players out on getting certain discs to help shot shape.
Yeah.
But I don't think there ever would be a time, like if we were doing it, we would probably ask like, hey, what manufacturer do you like? Right. And if they said Discraft, great. And then we'd run them through the Discraft lineup. I don't think it would make any sense for someone to come show up and be like, all right, and us giving them this disc from Innova and this disc from Gateway and this disc from Latitude and this disc from, I don't think that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Cause you don't really see that too often in golf either, of where if you get fitted, most people are going to TaylorMade Callaway, to get fitted, or you're going into a local fitting place that might have the option of giving you anything you want, but they're going to ask you like, what are you looking for? You're not going to get a 7-iron in TaylorMade and a 6-iron in Callaway, right? Yeah. You're going to get your full iron set, in one. Now it could be interesting. I mean, you could have someone say like, well, I really love the putters from Gateway. Right. And so then you give them like three different putters from Gateway, and then they're like, I like the drivers, and you do that. So I could see that in a mixed bag, but
yeah. Yeah, I think it's definitely something that we're going to explore, because we have some ideas how to go like a little bit more in detail and what it would look like. It's just figuring out the timing, location, and stuff like that. But it's definitely something that I think in my head, that's something where a local in-person store also has advantages, is because you can start to kind of expel some of that knowledge while someone's in the store and test, is that even something people are looking for right now? And I'm assuming it is. And then on top of that, be like, hey, you know, we actually offer this side service where we can take you out to the local field here, let you throw, you know, a wide variety. Yeah. I mean, it's a cool 25 grand, but hey, you get 10 discs out of it. No.
Yeah, but we do throw in 10 free discs.
Yeah, you get 10 free discs for that cost. You know, you're just paying for the knowledge. Ty Lopez style. I got these cars with knowledge. But no, I think there's definitely a market for that. It's just, again, I think that's the type of stuff that local disc golf stores have to utilize if they want to stay in business.
Nice. Should we do a few more?
I think one more. One more, oh, and we'll wrap it up. My
here we go.
Fourth niece was born and just came home, and if I leave early enough, I might get to go home and see her.
There you go.
So we're gonna wrap it up after this
Congrats.
One.
Congrats. Okay, Brandon White, hot take. He says college disc golf with the current team layout will fade out. Their team doubles format is a poor way to determine teams. I suggest using the NCAA D1 golf style. What do you think?
This is disc golf, not golf.
I mean, honestly, I think if it fades out, it has nothing to do with the format. I think if it fades out, it's from the structure up top, just struggling to figure it out in time. Because
is he saying fade out in the sense of like not exist?
No, the team layout will fade out.
Oh, I thought he was saying fade out as in not exist. Because the college disc golf layout format does is it forces you to have a deep team similar to match play, but it also allows for you to play singles like a normal event and weighs that in. And when you step back and look at what it is, it's beautiful. You know, I love it. I love the layout that it's currently played, the format of, because you can't have just one good player and ride their coattails to a national title. You have to have multiple players. They've solved that because previously you could have one great player and ride their coattails to national titles. You can't anymore. So I think that they've kind of solved the format. I think that where the biggest delay is somewhat on schools and somewhat on college disc golf itself in structuring conferences so that right now, basically, anyone can go to any qualifier and earn a bid. I think that, and they've talked about this, it just never happened, where you should be within a conference, a certain amount of teams from that conference come out and get into, like, you win your conference championship, you get a bid, whatever it may be, but then you get into regionals, and then there's, like, the super regions. You get out of the super regions, then you're in nationals. So by the time you get to nationals, same amount of teams have qualified, but there's a structure to it. Because right now, you could have a team, you could play one event, you pop off of that one event, you're at nationals, so you have a two-tournament season. So it's really hard to get rankings and stuff like that accurate in college disc golf, which rankings and stuff like that is what's going to make outside people care. Because it's hard to care when it's like, when we talk about college disc golf, we're like, yeah, you know, Missouri, I think, is number one in the nation right now. Texas is number two. That means absolutely nothing because realistically, Ferris State or Clemson might win this weekend at nationals. But it's just like which team played the most tournaments right now gets the most ranking points versus if there was conferences and stuff like that, there'd be more structure and then it'd be a lot more exciting. But the format itself, I don't think there's issues with. I think they've worked on the format enough. Let's focus on everything else first.
Nice. All right. There you go, Brandon.
Let's end it on this. Hunter, you are the starting running back for Alabama. You're playing at home against LSU. The game plan is to give you 30 carries throughout the game.
Love it.
How many yards are you getting?
I think I'm getting positive 3 yards.
That's it?
Me personally, yeah.
For the entire game, you're
well, yeah, because I think there's gonna be some where I lose 10 to 15 yards. How would there not
just be? Just fall down.
You're not even getting the ball 10 or 15 yards.
Oh, we're just snapping it like straight. We're snapping straight to me, or are we like snapping it back?
The quarterback's under center.
Okay,
and you're behind the quarterback in an I formation. Okay. By the time you get the ball, you're gonna be 3 yards.
I didn't realize we're running the exact same play every single time. I'm thinking that like there's going to be some.
What play are you starting 10 yards?
If there's like an option or something, I'm getting tossed over here and I'm trying to run back around the defense and I'm just screwed. I'm just factoring in me not being able to run fast. Essentially, what I was factoring in. So in that scenario, I'm getting to the line of scrimmage every time.
3 yards?
So, I mean, 30 yards. We'll say I can average a yard a carry.
Okay.
Because like that same, I get to the hole and I just swan dive.
Yeah. I don't think you're making it through the game, but.
Well, no. That wasn't the question. The question wasn't, do you survive? Because that answer is no.
That's part of the question.
Okay, then I stick with 3 yards because I think I get a carry, maybe two, and then I'm out. I'll stick with 3 yards.
Some 300-pound lineman.
I've never played football. I've never played football in my life. So if I get hit hard enough, I'm done. I'm out. I don't have built up endurance against getting hit.
Your left shoulder could potentially touch your right shoulder.
That's what I'm saying. Like if I would get hit and I'd fake an injury to just be off the field. But for someone who's fast, I think I still stand by your friend's claim. If someone was like a fast athletic person, not a crazy claim to average, because like you just got to get through the hole. Not a crazy claim, but for me, I'll go 3 yards. I think 3 yards.
Yeah,
I think that's fair. What are you getting? How many yards are you getting? 30 touches. Same scenario.
Right now.
We'll go college, Brody. You went to college for football. 30 touches. 30 carries.
I mean, I'm basically like. What was Derrick Henry? Wasn't Derrick Henry 6'5"?
I don't know.
Isn't Derrick Henry 6'5"?
No clue. I don't know random football players' heights.
That's not a random football player. He was the Heisman.
I still don't know his height.
Currently the best running back in the NFL playing for the Titans.
Still don't know his height.
Okay, he was 6'3", and he's a big running back. So I'm 6'5". You know, I'm probably getting like, maybe like 36 yards.
So you're thinking like a little over a yard a carry? You're making it through the game, or is that like you break out one or two?
No, I think I make it through the game. College Brody makes it through the game. I'm not going to be able to walk the next day.
Yeah.
But I make it through the game. And I think like there's a couple that I get like four, like maybe one or two carries. I get four. And the majority I'm getting anywhere from -1 to 1.
Yeah.
Is kind of where I'm at.
Makes sense.
But I think I would do the same strategy that you had, is like if I saw a hole, I would essentially like kind of put my head down and dive.
Yeah, I'm just getting out there. Just get me 4 yards somehow. Like just get me through.
I mean, you're not diving 4 yards. That's 12 feet.
Ball out, just sending it.
You're not supermanning yourself through the gap.
Watch me. Watch me. I'll just be fully.
I can see you like Superman yourself, and one of the linemen like gets their hand on you, where it kind of like launches you up a little bit.
Yeah,
and then a linebacker just comes and just clocks you going the opposite direction.
That's why I'm not making it through the game. Right there,
you just be like you just like turn into a folding chair. Like you just snap.
I'd bite my knees.
Yeah, it'd be bad. It'd be bad. But
all right, well there you have it.
All right,
hopefully you enjoyed this week's episode. Next week,
how many yards would you listeners, how many yards are you guys getting?
There you go.
Let us know in the comments. We want to know.
Yeah, let us know in the comments. If you're listening to this on audio, tweet at us and let us know. Fascinating question there to wrap up the show. And next week we'll have Brody 2 days before his first major of the year. We'll get his thoughts on that after a week of practice and see how everything's shaping up. For the first major of the year, so you're not going to miss that episode. Same time, actually, maybe not the same time. We'll post about it. Same place, though, next week on Tuesday, and obviously you can find us on Wednesday on all of your favorite audio platforms. Thank you all so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you all next week.